KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
It turns out that in 2024, we were creating just about the right number of jobs to keep up with the growth of the labor force.
There's a new jobs report out today showing that the U.S. workforce is far larger than was previously reported.
For Friday, February 7th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Trump administration is dismantling the main way that the U.S. distributes foreign aid.
If USAID funding stops, what could that mean for Haiti?
This is a real challenge, right? How do you unwind that dependence without having such an impact on the ground?
And ahead of the Super Bowl, we hear from a former Philadelphia Eagles player.
Sheldon Brown used to play for current Kansas City Chiefs head coach Andy Reid.
Coach Reid is a genius when it comes to building rosters, building high-character athletes that will do it the right way.
Those stories and more after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Donald Trump and his cost-cutting crew under DOGE are apparently ready to tackle just about every branch of federal government, including the Department of Education and the Pentagon. That's based on comments today from President Trump. Trump, after a meeting with Japan's prime minister, saying Elon Musk and DOGE will continue to look to downsize government, though he said the cuts are unlikely to rival those made at the U.S. Agency for International Development.
I've instructed him to go check out education, to check out the Pentagon, which is the military. And, you know, sadly, you'll find some things that are pretty bad. But I don't think proportionally you're going to see anything like we just saw.
At USAID, meanwhile, a federal judge has moved to temporarily block the administration's move to place more than 2,000 employees on administrative leave. The judge siding with federal employees associations that argue Trump lacks the authority to take such action. Several local governments are suing the Trump administration over its crackdown on policies limiting cooperation with immigration authorities. Juan Carlos Lohr of member station KQED has more.
Trump has threatened to withhold funding from local governments with these sanctuary policies and has asked federal law enforcement to investigate officials who don't assist in immigration enforcement. San Francisco City Attorney David Chu says these moves violate the Constitution's 10th Amendment, which gives states any powers not reserved for the federal government.
The Trump administration is asserting a right it does not have. They are trying to tell us how to use our resources and to commandeer our local law enforcement.
Santa Clara County, California, Portland, Oregon, New Haven, Connecticut, and King County, Washington are also joining the lawsuit. For NPR News, I'm Juan Carlos Lara in San Francisco.
Last week, President Trump ordered massive amounts of water diverted from two dams in California's agricultural heartland, falsely claiming it would be sent to Los Angeles to help battle wildfires. As Joshua Yeager of member station KVPR reports, it's much too early in the growing season for farmers to get much use from the water either.
Many farmers in the Central Valley say they're standing behind Trump anyway.
I don't think Valley growers feel that this was in any way done as an intentional, you know, attack on Valley agriculture.
Tricia Stever-Blattler runs the Tulare County Farm Bureau, which represents more than 1,000 growers in this area.
In general, farmers are supportive of what President Trump is trying to do in relaxing some of the really draconian environmental laws in California.
But any challenge to the way water is regulated in the state has an uncertain future. California sued over similar efforts during Trump's first term. For NPR News, I'm Joshua Yeager in Bakersfield, California.
Stocks went into retreat mode at week's end. The Dow fell 444 points. The Nasdaq was down 268 points today. You're listening to NPR. So much for the Trump bump, at least based on the latest consumer sentiment numbers from the University of Michigan. University's Consumer Sentiment Index fell 5% in preliminary February data. Much of the decline due to expectations the Trump administration tariffs, coupled with other actions, could be inflationary. With expectations, inflation this year could rise from the expected 3.3% rate to 4.3%. Economists saying it's extremely rare to see a 1% rise in inflation expectations. President Trump's threats to impose new tariffs on European goods have also caused Americans to suddenly stockpile their favorite Italian wines. That includes Prosecco. NPR's Ruth Sherlock has that story.
The statistics are clear, says Lamberto Frescobaldi of the Union of Italian Wines. Americans are not willing to give up on our vino. The Trade Association says US imports of Italian wine, mostly Prosecco, skyrocketed by 41% in November after Trump's election. This peak in orders is unprecedented, the association says, in the history of Italy's sparkling wine exports for the month of November. President Trump has threatened to slap new import taxes on European goods. Italy sends nearly one quarter of its wine to the United States. Last year, these exports totaled more than $1.9 billion. The Union of Italian Wine says tariffs could seriously damage this valuable market. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome.
Crude oil futures prices closed higher today. Oil up 39 cents a barrel to settle at $71 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. Hiring slowed last month as wintry weather blanketed much of the country, but the overall job market remained fairly strong. A new report from the Labor Department today also offers new insight into the role that immigration has played in keeping the jobs engine humming. NPR's Scott Horsley joins us now. Hi there.
Hi, Juana.
So, Scott, employers added fewer jobs in January than in the previous month. What should we make of that?
Well, today's report does point to a downshift in job growth. Employers added 143,000 jobs in January, only about half as many as the month before. The Labor Department says it does not appear that either the L.A. wildfires or the severe winter weather elsewhere had much of an effect on the job market, although it's possible they weighed on construction hiring, for example. We did see a loss of jobs in bars and restaurants at the start of the new year. But that said, you know, job gains for November and December were revised up by quite a lot. So if you take the average over the last 3 months, the economy is still adding jobs at a pretty respectable clip.
Okay, so it sounds like the job market is downshifting maybe, but not stalling out?
Yeah, that's right. And so long as that remains the case, the Federal Reserve is not going to feel much pressure to lower interest rates any further. Inflation is still higher than the central bank would like. Prices in December were up 2.9% from a year ago. The good news is average wages are going up faster than that. In fact, workers have seen wage gains about twice that in the last year.
So are employers able to find the workers they need right now?
Yeah, this job market looks to be pretty well balanced right now. There were a couple of notable revisions in today's report. Every year at this time, the Labor Department goes back and double checks its job numbers against more complete information from state tax records. And this year's revision shows that hiring was a bit slower in 2023 and early 2024 than initially reported. Employers added about 2.3 million jobs during the course of that year, down from the original tally of 2.9 million. Today's report also incorporates some new population estimates from the Census Bureau, which show that the U.S. workforce is significantly larger than we thought, with about 2.1 million more people working or looking for work at the end of last year. Now, most of that increase is because the Census Bureau had been undercounting immigration, and labor economist Jed Kolko, who worked at the Commerce Department in the Biden administration, says it's those newly counted immigrants who are helping to fill all those new jobs.
It turns out that in 2024, we were creating just about the right number of jobs to keep up with the growth of the labor force.
Now, that's helped to keep the unemployment rate low, right around 4%, while also avoiding the risk of an overheated job market that might fuel further inflation.
The new administration, Scott, has vowed to cut back on immigration. What could that mean for the job market?
Well, if the Trump administration follows through on those plans, it could limit the country's ability to keep adding jobs the way it has been. You know, whatever one thinks about the legal or security or personal effects of the administration's crackdown on immigration, Kolko says it will have an economic impact.
With less immigration or more deportations,
the labor force would grow more slowly than it has been. We might see slower job growth in industries which are estimated to depend more on unauthorized immigrants.
Now, some people like Vice President Vance have argued that will create more job opportunities for U.S.-born workers. But keep in mind, the population of U.S.-born workers is not growing very much. So this could put a cap on economic growth.
NPR's Scott Horsley, thank you.
You're welcome.
The Trump administration is systematically dismantling the main way that the U.S. distributes foreign aid through the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID. The administration froze nearly all foreign aid spending. Then came layoffs and a shutdown of the USAID website. Though today, a federal judge temporarily stopped the Trump administration from putting over 2,000 employees on administrative leave. Few countries are more reliant on USAID and American aid than Haiti. What has that long-term reliance meant for the country? And what happens if the aid suddenly stops? We'll put those questions to Jake Johnston from the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He's written a book about Haitian development titled Aid State. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So very briefly, how much aid does Haiti get from the U.S. and what is it for exactly?
Yeah, so there's a number of different ways to measure this. And through USAID specifically, it's about $400 million a year.
Okay.
And the way that money is divided up, you know, is generally in sectors, a significant portion in health, some in agriculture, quite a bit in this big bucket called governance. And then quite a bit of it also is distributed to multilateral organizations like the UN.
Okay, so USAID is not directly administering every single program that this funding supports. This money does get funneled to other organizations, maybe other subcontractors, if you will.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think this is an important thing to understand about how USAID works. Right? Over the last number of decades, it was increasingly reliant on contractors and grantees to actually implement its programs. In recent decades, that's actually included a number of for-profit development companies that are overall the largest recipients of USAID funding. And so these are the actors that actually receive the money from USAID and then implement the programs on the ground.
Okay, and these programs on the ground, I mean, they're for what sounds like very important things, agriculture, governance, public health. But you argue that this aid, and I'm going to use your words here, quote, circumvented the democratic process, eroded sovereignty, undermined local businesses and government, and served more as a benefit to U.S. special interest groups than to the local population. You clearly have criticisms of how this aid has been doled out and used in the past. Give me concrete examples here.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there are many that we could talk about with Haiti's history specifically. Mm-hmm. There was the USAID effort to eradicate the Creole pig, a local indigenous species that people in rural Haiti were extremely reliant on. And this was a USAID financed program in the 80s.
And why?
Well, ostensibly for health reasons. And they were going to replace them with imported pigs from America, right? But they were not, of course, adapted to the land and didn't last. Yeah. And so you had rural families, right, with their savings tied up in these animals, evaporated, right? Gone overnight, right? And so we can say, oh, right, people are hungry. We want to provide aid. And in fact, this is a big subsidy to U.S. agricultural producers, right? We take surplus agricultural mm-hmm. goods from the U.S. and we give them to poor countries like Haiti. And this solves a big need. Now, the problem is, over the long run, what that has done to Haitian agriculture is totally undermine it. And so over time, that has pushed Haitian farmers off of their land and eventually to the shores of the United States.
But on balance, do you believe that USAID does more good or more harm in Haiti?
I think the way you have to look at USAID is that, first, it's not monolithic. It's not one thing. And so there are parts of USAID that should justifiably be shut down, scrapped, greatly reformed. And there are also really critical things that USAID does today that is supporting lives, right? And so ending that overnight is going to have a deadly impact. You know?
And talk more about that deadly impact. What does the current aid pause mean for Haiti in the near future?
This is likely to have the greatest impact in the health sector. The health sector is extremely reliant on foreign financing. And so this is a real challenge, right? How do you unwind that dependence without having such an impact on the ground?
Then how much do you agree with how President Trump's team has been characterizing USAID? Like a recent White House statement claimed the agency, quote, funnels massive sums of money to the ridiculous and in many cases malicious pet projects of entrenched bureaucrats. end quote. It sounds like you do see some truth in that statement, that characterization.
Sure, I think it goes in a very different direction than how it's been portrayed, right? I mean, rather than funding pet projects around DEI or climate, I mean, they're funding pet projects of largely the farm belt and agricultural producers. I think the bigger question here is looking at what actually would be a reform to USAID to actually deliver effective assistance. And so the rhetoric might have some elements of truth to it, but are the changes that are being made actually going to change that dynamic? And I think it's really unlikely given what we've seen so far.
Jake Johnston is the Director of International Research at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
The Trump administration is pressuring federal workers to resign. Most federal workers, about 80%, live outside the Washington, D.C. area. And far from the Beltway, Alaska is one of the states with the highest percentage of federal employees in its workforce. Some economists say losing federal jobs there could have a profound effect statewide. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports.
David Traver is the chief steward for a union representing hundreds of workers at the Department of Veterans Affairs in Alaska, many of them health care workers. He says the threat of job cuts is creating anxiety.
We've all gone there and dedicated our lives to serving our veterans because we wanted to give back. And right now, what's happening is chilling.
About 15,000 federal employees live in Alaska, which is a lot for its small population. Many think of the oil industry as the biggest contributor to the state's economy. But the latest report from the State Department of Labor shows that's not so. The federal government employs almost twice as many Alaskans as the oil and gas industry does.
You know, the federal government is our number one industry.
Neil Fried is a retired state labor economist. He says federal jobs pay well, and losing them would reverberate through Alaska's economy.
We should be watching this really closely. I mean, it's kind of like, I suspect, the way people in Detroit watch what's happening in the auto industry.
University of Alaska Anchorage economics professor Kevin Berry says federal employees also support private sector jobs as they spend their paychecks and through the services they provide that advance oil and mining projects.
Research development in general requires people to answer the phone and help move permitting processes forward and get things done. So federal funding is not only large in the amount of money that it directly brings into the state, but the amount of activity that it enables.
Traver, the union steward at the VA, is urging his members not to take the Trump administration's deferred resignation offer.
I can tell you my phone has not stopped ringing with staff that are scared. We have staff prepping their resumes, looking for work elsewhere, nurses, providers.
It's not clear how many Alaskans have already offered their resignations or if the administration will cut positions to shrink the workforce there. For NPR News, I'm Liz Ruskin.
This is NPR News.
Everybody, this is Virgil. It is a little bit after 5 p.m., 5:20 at our broadcast headquarters. We will have coverage of tonight's Lady Eagles and Rookies game. I'm confirming it right now with Chris and Chris Babcock. But hopefully we'll have coverage at 6 p.m. and then 7:30 for the boys here in Sandpoint. I'll let you go back to the news and just wanted to break in and give you a heads up.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at metamucil.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. The Super Bowl matchup between the Kansas City Chiefs and the Philadelphia Eagles is just around the corner, and there is no shortage of opinions out there about who may come out on top on Sunday, but we wanted to take a step back and talk to two former players who have donned the helmets and the jerseys of these two proud franchises. Yesterday, we checked in with a former Kansas City Chiefs player, but today we are joined by former Philadelphia Eagles cornerback Sheldon Brown. Brown played for the Eagles for 8 seasons under head coach Andy Reid, who was with the Eagles for 14 seasons before he joined the Kansas City Chiefs. Nick Sirianni now coaches the Eagles. And Sheldon Brown joins us now. Sheldon, welcome to All Things Considered.
Yes, ma'am. Nice introduction. I appreciate that. Thank you guys for having me.
Okay, Sheldon, as we mentioned, you've played in a Super Bowl before. You've been under the lights. You've been at the big game. So if you could just start by walking us through what your preparation was like going into Super Bowl 39 and any advice you might have for the Eagles as they are counting down really the hours until the big game.
Well, I played for Coach Reid in Philadelphia at the time. So he made us very aware of, all the distractions that could come along with the week leading up into the game. But I think he did an excellent job of keeping us focused on the task at hand and mentally prepared. So for me, I really didn't have to adjust. I just think that first opening kickoff was amazing. You see 1,000 flashing cameras, and it's just, you can tell it's an epic experience. But I think once the game gets going and you get into the flow of the game, it's just another football game.
This is a rematch of that 2023 game when the Chiefs, which I will just note for people who do not know, my hometown team won 38-35. I mean, this is incredible to see these two teams coming back together again. How do you feel about that rematch with Coach Andy Reid?
Well, I am a diehard Andy Reid fan. Make no mistake about that. He gave me an opportunity to provide not only through the game, but he taught me a lot of life lessons. I go back and I look at Coach Sirianni, bring him into the picture, and I know how tough it is to deal with the Philadelphia market. Even when you win there, you suck, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a great place to play. The fans are excellent. But it's very tough to get everyone on the same accord because there are so many distractions that go on through the course of a season.
Sheldon, it's no secret for anyone who has watched you that loves football that you had a reputation as a hard-hitting, really physical player. And both the Eagles and the Chiefs, they have these explosive offenses. How do you think your Eagles can disrupt Pat Mahomes and the Chiefs' game plan in New Orleans on Sunday?
Saquon Barkley is going to be key. I think they have to control the clock through the run game, make the game long by keeping the ball away from Patrick Mahomes. Make no mistake about it, Patrick Mahomes and Tom Brady, they're neck and neck, right? They'll turn the ball over. You can't trick them and fool them with some of your pressures and blitzes and some of those schemes. And you can't turn it over. So I feel like the Eagles have to control the clock through the run game.
Last thing I've got to ask, what does your Super Bowl Sunday look like? What's the plan?
I think I'll have a few players. So I coach baseball now. I think I'll have a few players over to the house and we'll just watch it as a fan. And I'll be rooting for the Eagles, obviously. But, you know, if Coach Reid makes history, I'll be happy for him also.
That's Sheldon Brown. He's a former Philadelphia Eagle. Sheldon, I hope you enjoy the game and best of luck to your Eagles.
Yes, ma'am. Absolutely. Thank you guys for having me on today.
Whether the Federal Reserve raises, lowers, or maintains baseline interest rates is one of the most important economic decisions it makes. And that decision is made outside of presidential control, at least theoretically. Kenny Malone and Mary Childs from our Planet Money podcast had the story of what happened when one president wanted more control over interest rates.
In 1971, President Richard Nixon began secretly recording basically everything.
33 years later, virtually all of those tapes were publicly available.
Well, everyone else was interested in Watergate. I was interested in monetary policy.
Economist Burton Abrams drove down to the National Archives.
They were available on reels, and then you had to put on earphones and try to make out the garbled conversations that existed.
Arthur, how are you? Nixon says to Arthur Burns, chairman of the Federal Reserve.
Nixon was 1 year away from re-election, and unemployment had been rising.
So this will be the last conservative administration in Washington.
This will be the last conservative administration in Washington.
Nixon seems to tell his Fed chair to let more money flow through the economy, which generally helps unemployment but risks inflation.
Arthur Burns seems to push back and also seems to tap on the table to make this point.
I don't want to see interest rates exploding.
Burns is making an appeal to Nixon that he doesn't want to stimulate anymore. He's still holding out, yeah.
So I assume Nixon is not super jazzed about that meeting.
No, so I suspect that behind the scenes, pressure is still to give Nixon the monetary policy he wants.
According to Arthur Burns' personal diary, he was warned that White House operatives had their bayonets out for him, and that Nixon was threatening to pack the Fed board and completely take control.
The next month?
Burns began to give Nixon the monetary policy he'd asked for.
Yeah. Look, I want you to know that we are reducing the discount rate today.
Oh, I see.
Next month.
Oh, Arthur, how are you?
More rate cuts.
Yeah, good, good. What is it now? Four and a what?
It is possible that Burns believed this was the right move. Nixon had put price controls in place. Inflation appeared low.
But economist Burton Abrams thinks Burns capitulated to Nixon.
The Federal Reserve should not be treated as a branch of the administration.
Are you saying the fact of the meetings alone is troubling?
Yes.
I see.
When you get a personal conversation between the president and the Fed, there's too much possibility for a manipulation to take place.
Perhaps the most telling call came Christmas Eve, 1971.
You feel as far as after a money supply, we've got that about as far as we can turn it right now, have we? I mean, as far as my influence on him, that's what I'm really asking. Yeah. Well,
Nixon's talking to a cabinet member about Arthur Burns.
All right. Well, you watch it and then remind me if I have to talk to him again, and I'll do it.
Well, I'm sure...
Next time, I'll just bring him in. What?
I'm sure we'll have to keep after him, huh?
Yeah.
Saying, we'll have to keep after him. Next time, I'll just bring him in.
The loose money supply, the price controls, they likely helped re-elect Nixon in a landslide. They also get a lot of blame for the following year, inflation doubling, and then doubling again.
It was the beginning of one of the worst stretches of inflation in American history.
There's no law protecting the independence of the Fed. It is a norm, a kind of agreement that what's good for the sitting president is not always good for the economy in the long run.
Richard Nixon, it would seem, did not care at all about that norm. I'm Mary Childs.
And Kenny Malone.
NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. This is NPR News.
In his new memoir, Bill Gates recalls sneaking out in the middle of the night as a teenager, not to a party, but to write code. And those late night coding sessions laid the groundwork for the modern computing world we all live in.
Even the big companies, particularly IBM, didn't see what we saw.
We sit down with Gates and talk about his life before Microsoft on All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Super Bowl kicks off on Sunday in New Orleans, where business owners are hoping for a rebound after last month's terror attack.
New Year's Eve is usually the kickoff for busy season. And after what happened, it's been terribly slow for everyone out here. Everybody's hurting.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. On Capitol Hill, House Republicans are scrambling to meet President Trump's demand for a budget package that includes trillions of dollars in tax breaks, massive program cuts, and a possible increase of the debt limit to allow for more borrowing to avoid a government default. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries says Democrats are skeptical and won't support it.
What we've seen from Republicans in terms of the budget is that they want to end Medicaid as we know it, are considering eliminating the mortgage interest deduction, and want to take away veterans benefits and nutritional assistance from children and families. Is that something that Democrats will support? No.
As Trump wraps up his third week back in the White House, he's shaken government employees with threats of firing and foreign allies and trading partners with tariffs on exports. Washington State is suing the Trump administration over its order that targets gender-affirming care for transgender youth. Noel Gasca of member station KULW has more.
In addition to calling the order gross and hateful, Washington State Attorney General Nick Brown says the Trump administration's order violates the state's ability to provide medical care. Brown says the order also singles out trans youth for discrimination.
It is denying them health care that is not denied or attacked for anybody else, and that is a violation of the Equal Protection Clause.
At least one hospital in the state has canceled gender-affirming surgeries. Earlier this week, Seattle Children's Hospital canceled a gender affirmation surgery for a 16-year-old. The Trump administration did not immediately respond to a request for comment. For NPR News, I'm Noel Gasca in Seattle.
Well, stocks tumbled on Wall Street to end the week over concerns about U.S. tariffs as well as inflation. This is NPR News. Surgeons in Boston have transplanted another genetically modified pig kidney into a patient. NPR's Rob Stein tells us more about the latest experimental use of animal organs to help human health.
Doctors at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston say they transplanted the kidney into 66-year-old Tim Andrews of Concord, New Hampshire, on January 25th. And so far, the kidney, developed by a company called eGenesis, is working well. This marks the fourth time a patient has received a pig kidney that's been genetically modified to work in a person. Two of the previous patients died within weeks of their operations. An Alabama grandmother who got a pig kidney in New York in November is also doing well. Doctors hope genetically modified pig organs will help solve the organ shortage. Rob Stein, NPR News.
Dave Chappelle, Sabrina Carpenter, and Bad Bunny are among the guests set to celebrate the Saturday Night Live 50th anniversary special next week. It's a three-hour live telecast honoring many of the stars who've been associated with the show over the years, including Tom Hanks and Paul McCartney. That special airs February 16th on NBC, 2 days after an SNL 50 homecoming concert set to stream on Peacock. Well, stocks finished lower across the board to end the week on Wall Street. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. The latest chapter in the Trump administration's feud with the press is about government subscriptions to media outlets. NPR's Jude Joffe Block reports that the saga began with misleading claims on the social media site X.
Influencers on X have been sharing screenshots from a website that tracks government spending to highlight what they say is government waste. This week, the false claim emerged that Politico was receiving millions from USAID, the federal foreign aid agency that Elon Musk has been working to dismantle.
Politico, a news company which spent the last 10 years trying to destroy the MAGA movement, being massively funded by USAID, among many other government organs.
That was right-wing influencer Benny Johnson on his show on Wednesday. Later that day, White House spokesperson Carolyn Leavitt took up the issue.
I was made aware of the funding from USAID to media outlets, including Politico, who I know has a seat in this room. And I can confirm that the more than $8 million taxpayer dollars that have gone to essentially subsidizing subscriptions to Politico on the American taxpayer's dime will no longer be happening.
Politico put out a statement clarifying that it had not received one dime of government grants or subsidies. Rather, federal agencies used the procurement process to purchase subscriptions to Politico Pro, a service that tracks legislation and other policy minutiae. But the saga has continued to escalate. On Thursday, Trump posted on Truth Social, accusing what he called the, quote, fake news media of being paid off by federal agencies for, quote, creating good stories about the Democrats. He said this could be the biggest scandal of them all.
This is a new accusation, and it shows the ways in which information about government payment services can be harnessed for political reasons.
Josh Tucker co-directs New York University's Center for Social Media and Politics. He says it's been a long-standing tactic of Trump since 2016 to discredit the news media.
So is this taking it to another level? It's bringing in, you know, new types of rumors, and it's bringing in information about payments. And one thing we know is that people tend to trust numbers.
Now, a misleading nugget has progressed to a broad anti-media message.
At what point do we start pulling the press credentials of journalists?
That's Benny Johnson again from his show on Thursday. Johnson was talking to Republican Representative Scott Perry, who then relayed an exchange he says he had with a reporter from Politico.
He questioned me on the conflicts of interest with Elon Musk taking a look at the books, but didn't get the irony of the fact that Politico was just outed as taking federal money to report propaganda that they see fit. Like, he didn't see that as a problem. It actually is breathtaking.
Axios reported Thursday that the White House directed the U.S. General Services Administration to end government contracts with Politico and Bloomberg, among others, and cancel all of the GSA's media contracts.
The government can, of course, choose what sources it wants to subscribe to.
Chris Moore is the president of the Software and Information Industry Association, a trade group that represents some business-to-business media companies, many of which have long had government subscribers. Moore says people who work in the federal government need this kind of specialized information to do their jobs.
The idea that it would be cutting off intelligence completely would be extremely concerning and ill-advised.
Moore's trade group includes Bloomberg, which declined to comment. Jude Joffe Block, NPR News.
The Academy Awards are less than a month away, and one film leads the nomination count this year, Emilia Perez, with 13 nods, including actress in a leading role for Carla Sofia Gascon. The movie itself has already prompted critiques about its portrayals of Mexico and the trans experience, but the star Spanish actress has faced backlash for entirely different reasons over the past week. Miguel Macias reports from Seville.
Carla Sofia Gascon is the first openly trans actress to be nominated for an Academy Award.
She is from Spain, so many here celebrated the news.
From the members of the LGBTQ plus collective, we found that Carla Sofia is someone who has arrived at a very, very difficult place for someone like her.
That is Roberto Enriquez, also known as Bob Pop, Spanish influencer and writer. He says Gascón's nomination was a moment of pride for the LGBTQ plus community in Spain.
But suddenly, the tweets appear.
Last week, a number of Gascón's old tweets resurfaced. Gascón used slurs and offensive language against Muslim people, Chinese people, and George Floyd, among others. Just to cite a couple, quote, "How many times will history have to expel the Moors from Spain?" unquote. Or, referring to COVID vaccines, Gascón said, quote, "The Chinese vaccine comes with a mandatory microchip and two spring rolls," unquote. Gascón apologized for the tweets and said that she was deeply sorry for hurting people. The controversy could have ended there, but it didn't.
Creo que se me ha juzgado, se me ha condenado.
That is audio from an interview with CNN where Gascón says, "I've been judged, I've been sentenced, sacrificed, crucified, and stoned, without a fair hearing, without the chance to defend myself." Gascón has been on the defensive for the past week, sometimes lashing out at critics.
La reacción en España ha sido de estupefacción.
That is Elvira Lindo, a Spanish writer. She says that the reaction in Spain initially was astonishment, but while in the United States, stars can fall overnight if they do something wrong, in Spain, things are different.
España ha sido más
tolerante. Spain has been more tolerant or more open to forgiveness.
Perdón.
¿Cuál es el plan? O sea, mandarla a Guantánamo. Es que sí. No sé muy bien.
That is audio from an afternoon La Sexta television show, where the anchor says sarcastically, "What's the plan here? Send her to Guantanamo?" But the damage for Gascón's Oscar prospects has most likely been done. This week, The Hollywood Reporter said that Netflix dropped its Oscars campaign for the actress. NPR reached out to Netflix, but has not heard back.
Nobody deserves this kind of harsh punishment on an international level.
That's Elvira Lindo again. She says one thing that many in Spain agree on is that Gascón's tweets appear to show her political leanings.
Pues nos muestran a un personaje.
These messages show us a character that is reactionary and ideologically close to the political right in Spain today.
Some right-leaning opinion makers did come out in support of Gascón, accusing the left of giving her a pass just because they were afraid of criticizing a trans woman. Bob Pop says that Gascón might not be aware how her messages can be used by some as weapons.
Weapons for the people who think that she has no right to be herself as a trans woman.
Bob Pop says that the responses from all sides may tell us something about what we expect from celebrities.
Maybe we went too far when we adored Carla Sofía without knowing her. We are going too far when we create heroes or heroines. We're going too far when we try to destroy them because they have disappointed us.
This morning, Gascón said on Instagram that she will not speak up any further and just let the movie speak for itself. The question remains, is Carla Sofía Gascón still a contender for the Academy Award? The actress certainly hopes so. Miguel Macias, NPR News, Seville, Spain.
All right, we've got about 15 minutes to the start time. I want to let everybody know during this little lull in the NPR programming. This is Virgil, this is KSDP. We'll have Chris and Chris bring you live coverage from King Cove for the Lady Eagles and the King Cove Rookies. Back to the news.
Prison. Among other things, it called on the Bureau of Prisons to move trans women out of women's federal prisons and end gender-affirming care. Now, no incarcerated individuals have been moved yet, but in the meantime, the Bureau rolled out policies forcing trans women in federal prisons to hand over things like bras, dresses, and makeup. So what does this new policy mean for transgender women who are incarcerated, and what's been the impact since it was put in place? Well, for help answering that question, we're joined now by NPR's Jacqueline Diaz. Hi, Jacqueline.
Hi there.
Okay, so tell us what you've been hearing about these recent policy changes for trans people in federal prisons.
So this newly issued policy said trans women in federal prison have to hand over all of their female clothing and other items if they had them. Mm-hmm. It was the first clear evidence of how the agency planned to implement Trump's executive order, and that's as it relates to trans people in prison, that recognizes just two sexes, male and female. It also orders trans women to be sent to men's prisons and puts a stop to gender-affirming medical care. And this policy change on clothes alone is a big deal. Providing clothing that aligns with a person's gender identity is recognized as a key part of gender-affirming care.
Yeah, and I know that you have been reaching out to trans people who are currently incarcerated. What are they telling you?
Yes, so I spoke with one trans woman incarcerated in a men's facility in Texas. She told me this week that hearing this news was emotional, scary, and stressful, not to mention the loss of identity that came along with losing that clothing. I also spoke with Kara Jansen. She's one of the attorneys representing three trans women currently in female facilities who are challenging Trump's executive order.
The impact on our clients and on all transgender individuals in BOP is really horrific.
And a source that works in the Segoville Men's Federal Prison in Texas said the clothing policy that was just announced on Monday was put on hold by Thursday. And the inmate that I spoke to said clothes were returned by today. Both individuals asked us not to name them because they feared retaliation. And separately, a judge temporarily blocked the removal of the three trans women from a women's prison. The prison employee in Texas said that it looks like, for now, things are on hold. That is, until prisons across the country hear directly from the Justice Department.
Okay, and then what did the White House and Bureau of Prisons say about all these developments?
Okay, so the White House says that this is all being pursued with the goal to, quote, protect women. The White House says President Trump received a mandate from the American people to safeguard women's spaces from biological men. The BOP did not respond to our questions, and we have yet to hear back from the Justice Department. Kara Jansen said her clients have said that the constant changes are overwhelming.
Everything is changing every minute, and it's causing increased anxiety.
The stress is unlikely to stop anytime soon. The White House is intent on getting these policies on the books, and opponents in the trans community promise to continue pushing back.
That is NPR's Jacqueline Diaz. Thank you, Jacqueline.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Super Bowl fans have arrived in New Orleans ahead of the big game. The city expects over 100,000 people in town this weekend. As Matt Bloom with member station WWNO reports, many are noticing an extra layer of security in the tourist-friendly city.
Ahead of the NFL championship, fans are taking in the sights. Next to a line of mule-drawn carriages in the French Quarter, a group of Eagles fans from Philadelphia waits their turn to hop on a tour.
Great food, great architecture. I've taken a lot of pictures so far.
Danae Moreno is wearing a green and black jersey. She drove here as part of a family tradition of visiting Super Bowl host towns. She says another thing she's noticed is just how much law enforcement is around.
It definitely seems like there's more of a presence. It looks a little more than I saw in Vegas or even Arizona, because we happen to go to both the last couple years.
That's because officials have ramped up security after a driver intentionally plowed into a crowd here on New Year's Day, killing 14 and injuring dozens. Now over 1,000 officers from the National Guard, State Patrol, and local police have been deployed. They're visible on almost every street corner. On Bourbon Street, the state has installed new metal barricades to block cars at every intersection. No coolers or large bags are allowed, and military helicopters fly overhead. It's a big step up from the usual measures here, but fans say they appreciate it.
Well, right now I feel safe.
Chad Sylvie is visiting from Kansas City. He says he thought twice about coming after the attack, but his family didn't want to miss out.
My brother's coming down with his wife. My girlfriend's coming down. All my friends are going to get down here. We're going to have a good time and just kick it. I like New Orleans. It's fun.
Businesses are getting ready, too. Sean Flanagan is greasing a gas lamppost outside of his bar, Swig and Swine.
So that people can't climb up them.
He's hoping fans will spend money, though. January business was down by half after the New Year's Day attack.
New Year's Eve is usually the kickoff for busy season, and after what happened, it's been terribly slow for everyone out here. Everybody's hurting.
But he appreciates the extra security. Just off of Bourbon Street, Gianna McCarty is watching preparations from her front steps.
I think people are feeling they're bracing themselves.
She says it's strange to see armored cars and groups of armed soldiers right outside her house.
We're used to Mardi Gras parties. We're used to like crazy noise, but this is different. It feels different.
To try to diffuse the tension and boost the mood, the city held light shows, concerts, and food festivals all week ahead of its 11th time hosting the Super Bowl. For NPR News, I'm Matt Bloom in New Orleans.
Egyptian singer Kassoum died 50 years ago this week. She remains arguably the most influential Arab singer in and outside the Arab world. In Paris, there were 3 days of concerts to pay homage, and NPR's Eleanor Beardsley went to one of them.
Cairo National Orchestra played to a full house at Paris's Philharmonie Concert Hall. Lutes, flutes, and violins accompanying Kassoum's powerful love songs that washed over the spellbound audience. Classical singer Rahab Omar impersonated the Egyptian diva in Paris.
We often refer to her as the fourth pyramid, if you know, in Egypt, because she never left. I mean, she's gone, but her legacy is still living and will live forever.
Omar says she's honored to perform in the city where Kassoum gave her only concert outside the Arab world. Archival footage shows her legendary performance in November 1967. Ecstatic fans from across France's large Arab diaspora thronged Paris's Olympia Concert Hall. It came just a month after Israel's stinging defeat of an Arab coalition in the Six-Day War. Farid Boujalal illustrated a French graphic novel about the mythical concert.
The Six-Day War was a humiliation for the Arab world, and Kassoum helped people heal. She gave people dignity in the face of this trauma.
Putting on an Kassoum record from his own collection, Boujalal describes how some sold their valuables to buy a ticket. He says hundreds of French Jews who'd grown up with her music in North Africa also turned out. It was a moment of reconciliation between classes, ethnicities, and religions around the diva, he says. But Umm Kulthum was much more than a diva. Alain Weber, who organized the Philharmonie's anniversary concert program, says she was also an important political tool for Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser, who was trying to build a new Egyptian identity after toppling the monarchy and British colonial rule.
And Nasser used her a lot for that, to give hopes to people. In that way, she became completely the symbol, identity symbol of Egypt.
في الرابع من يوليو كل عام تحتفل الإذاعة المصرية بانطلاق إذاعة صوت العرب.
In the 50s and 60s, Kulthum's voice filled the airwaves from the Middle East to North Africa on Nasser's transnational Voice of the Arabs radio. The village girl who had once dressed as a boy to sing with her father at religious festivals also broke gender molds, says journalist Martine Lagardette. She co-authored the graphic novel on Umm Kulthum.
She was remarkable because she wasn't a militant feminist. She became president of the Egyptian Musicians Union, which was extraordinary at the time. She was close to Nasser. She played a real diplomatic role.
Umm Kulthum's voice was so powerful she performed to large crowds without a microphone. Poets and musicians clamored to compose for her, says Weber. Her songs typically lasted an hour and could put her audience into a trance.
Everything is focused on the poetry and the quality of the voice to bring you that kind of ecstasy, that kind of something that will move you completely inside.
Her 1966 hit, Al Etlal, The Ruins, is based on a love poem. Give me liberty and break my chains. The song's lyrics took on political connotations after the defeat of the Six-Day War. Some consider it the Arab song par excellence. Umm Kulthum recorded some 300 songs over her 60-year career. 5 decades after her death, her ballads of love, loss, and longing still drift from taxis and cafes across the Arab world, and fans still pack concert halls to hear her music in Paris. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
Strengthen me.